In this week's program, two people who know Italy well discuss David Gilmour's book, The Pursuit of Italy, a history of its land, its regions, and its peoples. The author is much preoccupied with the country's unification in 1861, in the light of the fact that there are so many different Italies. He sometimes wondered if Italy wouldn't have been better off divided into three or four states. He concludes that despite producing some of the world's finest art, music, and architecture, the country's history and geographical vulnerability have made it impossible for Italians to create a successful nation-state. Italy is either internationalist or regional, he says, but not really nationalist. With me, Cormac O'Curanoin, head of the Department of Italian at Trinity College Dublin and a specialist in the work of Dante, Boccaccio and Petrarch. Finbar Macaulay is Professor of Law at UCD. He's been a law reform commissioner since 2000. He spends part of each year in Rome. What did you make of the book, Finbar?
I enjoyed it hugely. I think it's a wonderfully executed piece of work, beautifully written, and for my money, wonderful, if idiosyncratic, celebration of the marvellous diversity of the peninsula, both cultural, linguistic, and so forth. In fact, if I may express a personal view, I was disappointed that the book was in some sense burdened by a kind of a central argument, a thesis that it should have been really about diversity and he should have stopped there. But he goes on, of course, as we know, to talk about the Risorgimento as a failure, as a kind of a huge mistake. I would have been quite happy had the book just been about the diversity and had he forgotten all about the great mistake, so to speak.
Cormac, your thoughts on the book?
Well, again, I agree it is beautifully written, an absolute pleasure to read. I would recommend it to anybody who just wants to curl up with a good book. It seems to me he sets out from the enigma that when you're in Italy, the particular place you're in is fascinating, interesting, lovely in so many ways, but that when you step back from it and think about Italy as a whole, you start to think of problems and things that don't work and what a state ought to be and isn't in this case, and you start getting very stern about it. And that sort of the contradiction seems to be what impels him into going back through an amazing sweep of history and even prehistory, because he goes back to geology to start explaining some of the difficulties Italy has had.
You go to Turin and you go to Naples and you say, do these or can these belong to the same country?
Yes, yeah. I mean that, and I think, I mean, if, beginning at the end, I think that he's convinced himself that unification was a mistake, and therefore I think it follows from that in his logical view of the thing that everything that happens after unification was a mistake, and that I think blinds him to some of the things that, in my opinion, at any rate, are not a mistake at all. I mean, there are aspects of even of the last 60, 70 years which are admirable. He makes, I think, rather snide remarks about the railways, for example. I don't know when he's last been on a high-speed train from Milan down to Naples, but you can get there now in 4 hours, and it's extremely... That's impressive. The huge success of the Italian fashion industry, for example, that's missing. I find that the success of the Fiat, for example, I mean, all of those. He does mention the fact that there were economic successes in the post-war period, but somehow maybe the significance for Italian identity of those successes he misses.
Is he right in saying, Cormac, that most histories have been written from a centralizing, unifying perspective? You know, as if unity had been preordained, as he puts it. Is he right in saying that?
I think so, yeah. Because if you're doing Italy or, you know, the history of the Italian language, generally what you end up with is you do a course. I mean, one that I teach about the Italian language. You end up with many, many languages. You start with many, many, many languages and you end up with one. And there's a tendency to think that all of those languages were somehow predestined to converge on the one. Similarly, with political history, you know, you have the great communes of the Middle Ages, Florence and so on. And you think, well, yes, these are important in themselves, but also because one day they're going to form a part of Italy. So he is trying to combat that that idea and, you know, not to be just fascinated by the enigma of the Italian nation today. At one stage, he says in the book, Italy was no more predestined to be unified than is Scandinavia. Mm. Now, you sort of feel that that's partly true, but it's also partly not true because in order to function as a society or as a set of societies from about the 19th century on, you more or less had to have a national label, a national identity. And one isn't exactly sure what the alternative would have been. He celebrates diversity, but then when it comes to the history of the Italian state, he protests against sort of pork barrel politics whereby local politicians compete for and get resources, a bit like the United States. But somehow doesn't make the connection that that is another form of regionalism. Yeah. In itself.
I thought, Barry, that he was keeping his option more open on unification. You think he's more or less closed them off? He doesn't
think so, yeah. Yes, I do. And I think, as I said at the outset, I think that's a weakness of the book. Mm. To go back to the point about diversity, linguistic diversity, the interesting point Cormac was making, I mean, I'm no expert, as Cormac would be, on the linguistic front, but even someone like myself, a frequent visitor to Italy, who's learnt Italian, and, of course, encounters the linguistic diversity of which he speaks, I think he's over-eggs the pudding because I'm not sure they are as mutually incomprehensible, many of these dialects.
What do you think of that, Cormac?
Well, language sort of became a badge of nationality from unification on. Mm. There was the great literary language going back centuries, and this was to be imposed and everybody was to learn it and speak it. But in fact, it took an amazingly long time.
And so just explain to us what happened after 1861. Did it just became more widely spoken?
No, it was brought into the school system. Mm-hmm. And, teachers were supposed to bring their students to a level of understanding of the national language. But of course, both the teachers and the pupils spoke the local language. And therefore, that didn't work. And then there was, industrialization, and there was the First World War, which was very good, mixed everybody for years in the same trenches. Mm. But even that didn't really bring a national language through. It was eventually the media, and especially television has made a nation of children whose first experience is sitting on the floor in front of the TV and listening to perfect Italian being spoken. So many of those things that might have come with unification and that were planned as policy initiatives, to show that we're a proper nation, didn't actually happen for a very long time. Those regional processes proved very strong.
Florence, the best place to learn Italian, right?
Well, so
the best English is spoken in Dublin. Yes.
I learned my Italian, I suppose, in Rome, which is heavily accented for that reason. To go back to the linguistic diversity thing, I remember when I'm a child of the 60s, and when I learned Italian first, one of the first things I tried to do was to read the novels of Pasolini. Because, of course, we had all seen Pasolini films in the 60s. And I was initially surprised to discover that they weren't in Italian at all. They were in, I suppose you'd call it a form of Romano, I guess.
Yes, Romanesco or Romanaccio, depending on how familiar you are with it. Yes,
but I was pleasantly surprised to discover that although this is one of the dialects, and although there was supposed to be mutual incomprehensibility between Italian, that dialect, and it and other dialects, I found that even with fairly halting Italian in my early days there, that I could read with difficulty, I admit. Another experience that comes to mind is when you find yourself, say, at a conference in Italy and you're chatting to people in your area and you may leave the table, you may go to the bar, whatever, you come back, they will have, in many instances, lapsed into their own dialect, depending on the part of the country they're in. Now, these would be, I suppose, members of the elite, if you like. They would be university professors, that kind of thing. And, of course, when you return to the table, they will then, as a mark of respect to you, they will return to the lingua franca, Italian in this case. Mm. So, again, I found that kind of dual identity, it was a very, very easy feature of Italian life. People, the campanilismo that he talks about as being something that precludes or excludes a unified sense of Italianness. Mm. I have never found that in Italy, I must say.
Singling out of Florence, Barry is flying the flag for Rome, obviously, for obvious reasons. But why does he single out Florence as the best Italian spoken there?
Well, it's the prestige of its writers from the Middle Ages. Mm. the fact that Florentines speak reasonably clearly, with one famous exception, the letter C, the hard C, sometimes eludes them. The fact, I suppose, that it's positioned halfway up the country and is relatively understandable on all sides. But in fact, what you often heard in Italy when I was there as a young person was lingua toscana in bocca romana. So speak the Tuscan language, but with a Roman accent. And that is, I assure you, perfectly acceptable. Don't worry at all about your accent.
the historical canvas, as you were saying, is a large one. Can I just zero in on one thing, Cormac, about an idea of Italy emerging in the century before the birth of Christ with Virgil as its laureate? The suggestion here is there's a reconciliation of the peoples of the peninsula after centuries of warfare. Just that one notion.
Yes, he talks about the idea of Italy as something that sort of flickered on and off. And it was, I think, often something that was distinguished from Rome. I mean, for the Roman Empire, Italy is very important, but it is a province. It's the home counties of the empire. But there was another idea of a league of Italian peoples, sometimes taking up the name Italia, but even that fairly sporadically. And he's mostly arguing that it didn't have the meaning then that has been ascribed to it later.
I was just struck, Finbar, when he said that Rome transformed itself from a city-state to an empire so rapidly there was no room for nationalism. That's the kind of picture right through, isn't it?
I mean, I think his I'll go back to the point that you've raised in a moment, but his concept of nationalism, I think, we need perhaps to interrogate, because my understanding of nationalism is that it is an essentially 19th century conception. And the idea that you would be looking for antecedents for this essentially 19th century conception, millennia, you know, or even centuries before it actually happened, seems to me to be a rather odd thing to do. That would be my first point. Secondly, he seems to think that nationalism has to have, beneath its kind of label, a kind of cultural homogeneity. Again, there are many examples of successful nation states that would have as much, in my judgment, would have as much diversity. One thinks maybe of Britain, a significant diversity.
Sure, but his point, though, that, you know, that you're really talking about it either being essentially international or regional, that the kind of national feel, if you like, is not as strong as those two. Is that right?
I think that's debatable.
Yeah, you, Cormac?
One of the countries he praises a lot, and I think rightly, is Austria. Mm. He keeps pointing out the Austrians did a pretty decent job of running those provinces of what is now Italy that they previously owned, although Italian nationalists would not thank me for saying that. That was a country that organised itself between two very, very different languages and nationalities in Austria and Hungary. So it's perfectly possible to have a successful state and a successful even sort of nation within it. In other words, I mean, today we live in the EU, and it's not particularly difficult, despite current problems, to have different arrangements at different levels. I think what Finbar is saying about identities overlapping sort of being contradictory if you put them on the same level, but once you separate out the different strata of identity, it's perfectly possible to function.
And I've felt, Cormac, as well, that his use of the Roman example, to go back to the point you earlier made, was unfortunate, because Rome is a wonderful example. I'm talking now about classical Rome. Is a wonderful example of how you can have overlapping multiple identities. You thought of yourself as a citizen, but you might also have loyalty to whatever part of the country, of the peninsula that you originated. And you mightn't even be from the peninsula at all. You could even become emperor, as we know. That works against his argument, the fact that he seems to be suggesting that Italy fails because there isn't this unified identity.
Yeah.
But you find, in my judgment, plenty examples of multiple overlapping identities which work quite happily.
Yeah, he doesn't seem
to get
sensitive
that.
To that
no.
notion.
Well, I would slightly dispute that. I feel that although his thesis is, you know, a bit failed state, nice society, I feel that he does actually concede that there is a lot of stuff that works well, and that the Italian experience as a state hasn't been entirely negative. So, I mean, as Finbar was saying at the start, the thesis is in some way a bit of a burden to...
I mean, he's even kind to the fascists, you know. He doesn't... I mean, he's not happy with sort of the notion that fascist Italy was a total disaster.
No, well, I mean...
For one thing, that it wasn't a cultural desert.
I think huge numbers of the people in the ranks of Italian fascism were there simply as a matter of necessity or convenience. I mean, I think the universities are a classic example of this. Mm. I think at one point you had to sign up. You could not be in a university position unless you were accredited and had signed up with the fascisti. Mm. But of course, after the war, what happens is that these people then suddenly morph into communists and socialists and become leading intellectuals and leading lights.
It's interesting to get somebody as complicated as Pirandello appearing in that fascist period, Cormac.
That is astonishing. But I think it was the absurdity and pathetic nature of authoritarianism, the self-contradictions within it, that actually spurred Pirandello to become a fascist and put on the black shirt. Mm. What's more interesting is characters like Moravia, who was afterwards a very strong anti-fascist, but during fascism was a very strong, at least in words, a very strong fascist. Well, it's true that Italian fascism was, you cannot tar it with the brush of German Nazism. It is not on the same level. It's even not as horrible as Franco's Spain.
Not as bloodthirsty,
Not at all, no. Mm. And this is the other point about that perhaps...
Isn't there a danger, though, of simply aestheticising it out of existence on the other hand?
Fellini does a lovely job in Amarcord, where I think the worst thing that happens you when you're captured by these rascals is you're forced to drink cod liver oil. There's a wonderful scene in Amarcord. Yes. And, I mean, I don't think you want to sanitise it quite to that degree, but I think there is something in that image.
But at the same time, what he does do is he points out that the Risorgimento was itself extremely violent in places with horrible massacres of the actual Italian population, which the fascists actually didn't do all that much. But so he is concerned, I think, more to ramp up the description of violence in the unification process and immediately afterwards, and then to say, well, whatever you may have heard about fascism, yes, it was bad, but it wasn't all that bad. And I think it's possibly the German experience spilling over that most of us assume naturally that fascism leads straight to the concentration camps of the Third Reich.
More supporters of communism than elsewhere in Europe, more supporters in Italy. How is that to be read?
Well, I think partly because of the morphing process that I referred to earlier, an awful lot of these people simply... I mean, for example, if you wanted a job in Rai 3, one of the national TV stations, you had to be a card-carrying member of the party, and that has continued right up into the 1980s. If it doesn't,
it's almost
does
the
it
case.
Still continue?
Well, I mean, I was just checking out there. I used to watch Rai 3 news before my satellite suddenly stopped transmitting it. And news was often presented by a lady called Bianca Berlinguer.
Correct.
Who is now the overall head of the station. Mm. And she is a daughter of, this is very Italian, the admirable communist leader Enrico Berlinguer, whom we all miss so much. And there is a sense of dynasty and protectionism and separate spheres even going on today. Now, obviously, the largest example of this being the Berlusconi Empire.
Do you remember Eurocommunism in the 1970s when one associated that more with Italy than other European states, perhaps for the reason you've given? Yeah.
And he only devotes, by my calculation, he devotes, I think, only 66 pages of the entire book to the period from 1945 to the present day, which is a great pity given that, in his own terms, the book is meant to be a study of Italian identity, and I think that there's a huge missed opportunity there. I'm thinking, for example, of the diaspora. I think there are 25 million Italians throughout the world. You can't go to any major city in North America without encountering significant numbers of Italians. Now, they think of themselves, on one's travels, I find myself gravitating towards Italians. I like their company, enjoy their company very much. And any members of the diaspora I meet in places like Argentina, for example, there's a huge Italian community there, all over the United States, they think of themselves as Italian. That seems to me to, in some degree, to work
run
against...
Run counter to his thesis, yes.
It does.
Yeah, yeah.
And also there's been huge, I'd like to hear Cormac on this, there's been huge internal migration. I mean, since the 1960s, I think there's been massive movements.
From where to where, mainly?
From the north to the south. South to the north, looking for work. And, you know, these people, so the idea of the Apennines, a big part of his thesis is that the Apennines has made Italy, even internally, kind of lacking in communication.
Do you think he's good on the Christian Democrats and the Mafia, Giulio Andreotti being the sort of linking figure here?
Well, he's very interesting on that whole phenomenon. I mean, Italy, after unification, was governed by anti-clericals. Mm. One of its prime ministers was of Jewish origin and brought up as a Protestant. There wasn't the clerical domination that there later came to be. For example, when a priest set up a popular party trying to give a voice to Catholicism in Italy, he was instantly suppressed by the Vatican and sent off to America. But after the war, the church woke up and realised that they could actually participate in Italian society.
So originally had refused to recognise the new state. Yes.
So there was this huge hiatus where the kind of political power of Catholicism was never unleashed. And when it was finally let out of the bag, essentially it took over to an enormous extent. And he points out, Gilmore points out, that you then had a society, had a government that was sort of legitimised in the eyes of a large numbers of the population that wouldn't have considered themselves to be quite at one with the state before. But with that comes, I suppose, with the increased reach of Christian Democrats. I mean, they were an all things to all men party in many ways. That brings them into contact, certainly, with the local power brokers everywhere. And if you're in favour of regionalism and regional identity, if you wish to survive well in Sicily, you may well be getting votes from people that are questionable. I mean, Berlusconi won 61 out of 61 seats in a recent election in Sicily. That's a fairly high number. It suggests that he was well got with whoever advised the local voters.
And no political politician has had such a hold since Mussolini. If I remember, Finbar, you've had not altogether unkind things to say about Berlusconi in the past.
I would have most unkind things to say about him as a man.
Yeah.
But my main point about Berlusconi always has been, when you'd be talking to people who cannot understand how a civilised people could have such a man as their head, was that you've got to understand politics in terms of the choices available to the voters. And, you know, millions of perfectly respectable, hardworking, middle-class and working-class Italians voted for Berlusconi because they saw him as the lesser of two evils. That's really my central point.
Yeah.
They simply, every time they tried the left alternative, the country got, in their opinion...
It's not that you want to fly a flag for Berlusconi.
No, absolutely, anyway. Absolutely.
The 2004 index, only Greece was more corrupt than Italy. Is this the thing that bothers them? This
is a really interesting point. You would think that if large-scale corruption and personal misbehaviour were revealed on an enormous scale, people would recoil in horror and say, well, whatever we have, we won't vote for that. Mm-hmm. And considering that even if you were wishing to vote on the right, you know, there was at least one other leader, the former fascist Fini, who seemed to be offering some kind of honourable government, you would think that this would be really bad for Berlusconi. In fact, the opposite has more or less been the case. People have thought, yes, if I was in his position, I think I'd enjoy those things too. There's a nice passage here. Berlusconi's message to men was simple. This is quoting from the Gilmore book. I am like you, and you can be like me if you try. You too can be famous, rich and seductive, even if, like me, you are small and not very handsome. So yes, he's perhaps a little unkind to Berlusconi. But corruption doesn't register as a disqualifier in quite the way you might expect.
The other interesting thing about Italy, I find, is that this campanilismo that Gilmore refers to frequently, I think it works.
By which he means...
well, loyalty to the bell tower, literally, rather than to a central authority. I think it works wonderfully well and has a huge importance for the Italian character in the sense that you
Forgive me, it's not just the family, it's that as well.
Well, it's, certainly the family is a huge thing. But I think he's using that as a kind of a metaphor for one's local loyalty as opposed to the state. But the positive thing it has, in my judgment, is that you don't, at least as I see it, you don't get the kind of almost pathological self-loathing that you would expect to get in a country which is so dysfunctional. And I think the reason you don't get it is because people have this dual identity. They can think of themselves in terms of their local region and its positive virtues, and therefore they don't beat themselves up to quite the degree, for example, that you find in Ireland. You find, you know, even huge segments of our media, there was such a virulent hatred, say, of Catholicism, precisely because we defined ourselves almost exclusively in terms of those central forces. That didn't happen in Italy, as I see it, and consequently, you don't. I mean, he does analyse the contemporary literature. Cormac would know more about this than I. But my sense of the Italian, general Italian feeling, sense of themselves, is that they don't feel as pathologically unhappy about their lot, precisely for that
reason. He also throws in the network of charities, as he's talking about the family, the communal loyalties. And what does he mean by network of charities?
What the Italians call volontariato. People are hugely involved in local initiatives and charitable good works. This strengthens what he points out, the communal life, that your sort of your proximity identity is often very well sustained by the fact that people genuinely do a lot of good works in a very involved way, which is highly personal. I mean, one of the paradoxes for an Irish person going to Italy is that Italy is a very big country, but it feels a bit like Ireland because it has so many networks. And the networks mean that you know somebody who knows somebody who introduces you to somebody. You are quickly surrounded by an almost village atmosphere. That's very sustaining, and it means that your personal level of motivation and satisfaction may be very high. But transfer that onto the national scene, where there are villages of people who know each other making decisions for a whole big, big nation, and maybe it isn't going to work so well.
We've been discussing The Pursuit of Italy by David Gilmour, published by Penguin Books. My thanks to Cormac O'Cullinoin and Finbar McCauley. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie and also on the RTE player. Till next week, bye-bye.